Well, I think if you go back to 3 a.m. on November the 9th, 2016, that sound you heard was the sound of liberal heads exploding in Cambridge, Massachusetts, in the Upper East Side of New York. The liberal elites could not believe that Donald Trump was president. Their ultimate nightmare had come true. Something that they'd attached a very low probability to had happened. And I think they're still going through the stages of grief. Many are still in denial. And one way that that manifests itself is with very, very hysterical claims that Trump is a fascist, that the Republic is about to be overthrown and a tyranny established. And from where I'm sitting, that all sounds completely over the top. When you move away from what's being said and look at what's being done, this is an increasingly normal Republican administration, I think.
Well, let's talk about some of those measures, the economic measures. Two in particular you mentioned that seem perfectly sensible mainstream Republican policies, cutting corporate tax and deregulation. Explain why you're a fan of these.
Well, I think a lot of people got confused because Donald Trump on the campaign trail talked a lot about protectionism, bashed free trade, bashed NAFTA, bashed China. But since he's actually been inaugurated as president, the protectionism has clearly been dialed down. And what we are hearing much more about is tax reform, the repeal of Obamacare, and deregulation. And the reason that those are normal Republican policies is that they are, in fact, Republican policies. Those policies were really the ideas of Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, who is really the brain of the Republican Party in Congress. And Donald Trump essentially adopted those policies along the road after he became the Republican nominee. When you look at what's now going through Congress in what will be a 200-day extravaganza of legislation, nearly all of it is authored by Paul Ryan and his colleagues. And all Trump has to do at this point is just say, go for it, lads, and get out the way. And I think in that sense, the normalization process is happening because the Republicans in the House and the Senate know what they want to do and are experienced players in what we know from TV as the House of Cards, whereas most of the people in the White House are completely new to politics and are having to find their way around Washington and learn the hard way that it's a very, very different place from New York City real estate.
But what about some of the non-economic sideshows? Could they derail him? He's already lost one member of his administration over links with Russia. There are others who are under pressure. Then his constant chirping with the media. Do these concern you? Could they become major issues?
Yes, I think they do concern me. I think it's a very big mistake to pick a fight with the press. Richard Nixon did it in almost exactly the same way back in 1969. And I don't know that it makes any sense at all in the light of that history, because having declared war on the press, Nixon then became public enemy number one for the Washington Post, and eventually they got him over Watergate. So I think I worry about that. I don't think it makes sense, and I don't think the president will win that any more than he won his early battle with the law courts over his executive order on immigration. I worry even more about the Russia issue. The links between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin are murky, to say the least. And it must be said that the president and his men are not handling this issue well. Stories are being told and then turn out to be wrong. It begins to smell of a cover-up. Well, that's exactly what the press wants most, a cover-up a la Watergate. So President Trump has to get out of this fight with the media and focus on what he does well, which is addressing the American people and selling the agenda of the Republican Party in Congress. That's his job. He needs to stick to it.
Let's take a step back, if we can, and talk about some of your books, of which I'm a big fan. And I was thinking, if I'm going to get to meet Neil Ferguson, what am I going to ask him about? And I touched on your book, Civilization, and this concept of why the West was this great power for half a millennium, what the rest of the world got wrong, and then that balance being addressed now. And I've always thought, I'd love to ask you, take that sort of analysis, that framework, and apply it to what's happening in the UAE at the moment and has over the past few years. What would Professor Ferguson make of that? So, if you like, a two-part question, just remind us of the quick overview of that thesis, and then how does it apply to the UAE?
Well, the argument of the book Civilization was that around about 1400, 1500, 1600 or thereabouts, societies in northwestern Europe came up with what I called the six killer applications of modern civilization. These were ideas and institutions that were highly conducive towards economic growth, social stability, and political evolution. One was just the idea of competition as something legitimate in economics and politics. Another was the scientific revolution. A third was the idea of the rule of law based on private property rights. Then there was modern medicine, which doubled and then tripled life expectancy. The idea of a consumer society is something inherently desirable, without which there's no point having an industrial revolution. And finally, the work ethic, that strange thing that Max Weber spotted when he thought about the spirit of capitalism. The argument of civilization is that these six things can be downloaded, that's why they're like killer applications, anywhere. And once they had been developed in countries like Britain, they spread. And they spread very rapidly, especially where British people went and settled. In our time, in the recent past, the striking feature of the world is that more or less everybody is learning that these ideas and institutions work. And it's nothing specific to northwestern Europe that makes these ideas successful. You don't have to be white, you don't have to be Christian, you don't have to live in a place that gets cold in winter. These ideas work everywhere. And I think the lesson for the UAE is very obvious, and I think already has been applied to a very significant extent. UAE stands out in the Arab world for its institutional advances, increasingly competitive economy. You have science flourishing in academic institutions, including the one we're sitting in, the New York University offshoot here in Abu Dhabi. The rule of law is certainly more advanced here than in many other Arab countries. And I could go on. In that sense, the UAE illustrates the strength of this analytical framework because it divorces culture from institutions and ideas. A very, very important theme of my work is that the success of the West in the 1500s, 1600s and thereafter had nothing to do with race or religion or geography or any of those things. It wasn't cultural. It was about ideas and institutions. And that's great news because it means that everybody in the world can benefit from good ideas and good institutions.
A couple of final questions. Your most recent book is about Henry Kissinger, 93-year-old US diplomat who's still going strong. Of all the things, all the people you could have written about, why him? Why now?
I moved to the United States about 14 years ago and began thinking that I should write an American book, but what would the subject be? It's not as if I had a comparative advantage in US history. But the case of Henry Kissinger is uniquely appealing to me. A, he started life in that German Jewish milieu that I studied for much of my early career. B, he was really a historian before he became a political player. And C, I just got lucky. And he suggested to me that I write his biography. So the stars aligned. And after a little hesitation on my part, because it's a daunting task, I said I'd do it. And I'm very glad I did, because with every passing year that I work on it, his ideas about diplomacy and strategy seem to me more and more relevant. And if I think just of the Middle Eastern region, his achievement in the 1970s looks more and more impressive today when so much of it appears to be unraveling.
Final question. You're a historian, an economist or an economic historian in many ways. You have taken one of the most dry, dull subjects imaginable, and you've said this yourself, and made it sexy. You make TV programs that people watch. You write books that people actually buy and read. How on earth do you do that? What's the communication alchemy that Niall Ferguson uses?
I guess back in 2006, I was having an argument with a producer at Channel 4. I wanted to make a television series about financial history. And he was rolling his eyes and suggesting that that was rather a dull dry subject for TV, and particularly when I started talking about an entire 1 hour film about mortgages, including subprime mortgages, he exclaimed, why would anybody want to know about subprime mortgages? Well, 2 years later, when the financial crisis struck, everybody was talking about subprime mortgages. And I remember saying to him, look, you may not be interested in finance, but finance is interested in you. And the financial crisis, when it struck, made everybody aware that they needed to know where the financial system came from. And the point of The Ascent of Money, which is the book I was working on then and the television series that we duly made with its 1 hour on the mortgage market, the aim was to educate people and to help people understand the system within which we all live. We may find it difficult to understand, but I think we understand it better when we know where it all came from. And that's what motivates me to write history books. I don't understand things till I know the backstory. And I think everybody's like that. You can't really understand something till you know where it came from.
And a final follow-up to that, but how do you make it palatable? Because many people have written about these issues before, and yet people find it inaccessible. You make it accessible. Is that just intuitive, or are there some tricks that you can teach people to try and make these subjects more palatable to a wider audience, to people who need to understand them?
I think many academics make the mistake of addressing only academics. And the more they do that, the more they use language that to ordinary people is incomprehensible. When I started trying to popularize my work using television, I always tried to explain things as if I were explaining them to my kids. If you can explain something to your children, then you really understand it. If you can only explain it to your peers, it may be that you're just bluffing. So I always apply the test on any problem. Can I actually explain this to my kids? And it's a very good rule. And I'm afraid to say great many academics flunk it because they're far too used to talking in abstruse language and jargon and making assumptions and logical leaps that children see through. So that's, for me, always been a key. And every time I look at a camera or stare down a microphone, I'm trying to make sure that if my teenage son were sitting behind you, he wouldn't be kind of checking his phone and zoning out.
Professor Ferguson, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.